Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 23 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast. Dave Musgrave here. Dylan Hales is on the line as always. And we're joined this week by the King of Montreal, Tat LaProd, who has joined us this week to discuss the history of wrestling in Montreal. How are you, Pat?
Very good. I didn't know I was the Elvis Presley of Montreal, though, but I'll take that as a compliment. I'm doing fine. Yourself, guys?
Well, we're doing well. I was thinking of you as the Jerry Lawler, mostly for your penchant for dating younger women.
Well, if I can really be like Jerry Lawler, and we'll see when I'll be like 55 or 60 and see if I can, you know, pick up like 20 or 30 years old chick, you know, we'll see then.
Yeah. Can you guys still hear me?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I thought I had an issue with my phone for a sec. So yeah, some people may not be familiar with you, but I have mentioned you on the show before, Pat, because coming in February, you were going to be a published author. Could you talk about that with us for a bit?
Yeah, definitely. And next February, me and Bertrand Hébert, a longtime booker here in Montreal for NCW promotions, and, you know, a wrestling fan of over 30 years, we're going to be publishing a book on the history of pro wrestling in Montreal, the very first one book. And you know, if there is some French listener, you probably heard of a book written by Jacques Rougeau, but about the history of Montreal. But that was really not about the history of Montreal. And it was more, you know, just about a few guys and his career. But our book will really be the first one, 460 pages, with about 200 pictures on the history of one of the greatest wrestling territory of all time. It's going to be called Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, the untold story of how Montreal shaped the world of wrestling. Probably the book with the longest subtitle I've ever seen, but it says, you know, it says it all, you know, and even the title, you know, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs. Well, you know, you probably heard of a guy named Mad Dog Vachon, but what people don't know is that, no, you never heard of Mad Dog Vachon. But what people may not know, is that there was another Mad Dog as well in Montreal, Mad Dog Lefebvre. Or maybe, as you guys would say, Mad Dog Lefevre, maybe. I'm not sure how you guys pronounce that. But he was a hell of a wrestler as well, a childhood friend of Raymond Rougeau. And there was even a battle between Mad Dog Vachon and Mad Dog Lefevre in the beginning of the 80s about, you know, the Mad Dog's name. So that's why Mad Dog's, it has an S at the end because there was more than one Mad Dog. Midgets, you know, obviously because of guys like Little Beaver and Sky Lolo and Little Brutus, Tiger Jackson, who played Dink in the WWF. They were all midget wrestlers from Montreal. The very first promoter of the midget wrestler was Gino Brito's dad, Jack Britton, another guy from Montreal. And on top of that, we strongly believe that the very first midget match was held in Montreal, even before Jack Britton promoted the midgets. So for all these reasons, midgets really had to be in the title. And finally, screw jobs. Well, you know, of course, the Survivor Series 1997 with one of the most famous wrestling match of all time, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart. But what people, again, may not know is that there was another screw job in May of 1931 in Montreal between Henri de Grand
That was actually going to be one of our first questions. That was going to be one of our first questions for you.
Yeah. Well, see, I'm the kind of guy that you're going to ask one question and they'll probably answer two or three following questions.
Good.
So it was Henri de Grand against Strangler Lewis, and that was said to be the first Montreal screw job, even though some historians are not really sure if it was in a work match or not. But you know, most of the people believe that it was a screw job. So the three, you know, in the same title, really recap the great history of the Montreal territory.
Yeah, well, with the DeGlane, Ed Strangler Lewis. Yeah, we've been talking about the book for a while. We can't wait for it to come out. And I actually thought the Mad Dogs part. I didn't realize that was your logic. I just thought it was a poor translation. But no. Sorry, that's bad.
That's nice. That's not nice.
No, I know. Pat, with the Henry DeGlane Ed Strangler Lewis match, can you describe for people like what happened in that match? What it's reported to have happened?
Yeah, basically the promoter in Montreal was Boston's promoter Paul Bosser, who was one of the most influential promoters out there at the time, and even in the history of wrestling. And he
1931.
That was in May 1931, exactly. And the thing was that Strangler Lewis had lost his belt prior to that show, and he was supposed to get the title back. If not, he was supposed to get something like $20,000 or $25,000 bound for not getting the title back. And Paul Bosser decided not to give him back right away. So there was a match between, and if I'm not mistaken, it was between Ed Down George and Strangler Lewis. You know where that old, you know, Lewis told Down George at the beginning of the match, we can do this the hard way or the easy way, you know. And finally they had a wrestling match, but you know, Lewis took back the belt. So Bosser didn't like that, obviously. So he booked a match in Montreal between Lewis and Henri de Grand. At the time, there was not really a strong wrestler coming out of French Canada. I cannot say this word in English at all. Okay, so I'll say a strong French Canadian. I'm better off that way. Yvon Robert hadn't started his career yet. So Henri de Grand was probably the closest, you know, wrestler to a French Canadian because, you know, of the language thing. He was from France. So he was really, really popular in Montreal. So he booked a match with him and Henri de Grand. And what happened in the match is that after de Grand won the first fall, apparently they went back in the dressing rooms, and one of de Grand's corner men, or himself, you know, this is something that we'll probably never know, let's say it was the Grand, so he bit himself on the arm and went back in the ring, you know, for the second fall. And right from the beginning, you know, they started working, and at one point, he had Lewis in a kind of a headlock, you know, or, you know, Lewis' head was near his arm, and he just let go Lewis and, you know, scream like he just got bite or, you know, hurt, actually. So the referee went to him, saw the bite marks, and just disqualified Lewis and gave the match to the clan, and he won the title from that. Bosser was regaining control of the what was called at the time the AWA title, which is not the AWA from Vern Gagne. It was the AWA title from the Boston territory, It is truly the title that if you go back in history, this is the title that is really linked to the Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt title reign, and not the and the NWA always claimed that it was their title was going back to Gotch and Hackenschmidt, but in reality that was that AWA title that was linked to those two great wrestlers from the past. So that was it was also called, well, obviously it wasn't called the Montreal Screwjob at the time. It was called bite match, something like this. Yeah, it was called the bite, the bite match or something with bite. I can't just remember what it was called exactly because I'm always calling it the Montreal Screwjob, the first one. But and after the match,
was it something in French or?
No. It was in English actually. That's probably why I don't remember it. but it was I truly believe it was the bite. It will come back to me as we talk. And as the legend goes, after the match, Bowser had a few guys with him, in case that Lewis wanted to start trouble. And Lewis just didn't mind and said, something like, "I don't care about your title, and blah blah blah." So that was the first. This is a short summary. We're talking about it in the book much longer, but that was the first Montreal Screwjob.
Awesome. It sounds like they needed CSI to come in there.
Pardon me?
They needed CSI to come in there to check the bite marks and stuff.
Well, actually, I've read the newspaper clips from that time, and of course, it says that the doctors verified the bite marks and stuff, but who really knows,
Yeah, I have a question about DeGlain. He's a guy who seemed like he was a really big star. I guess obviously, he's sort of the. He's a European, sort of one of the few European wrestlers, or wrestlers of, from Europe that I think a lot of people sort of vaguely know in name. But he was a pretty big star, I think, throughout Canada during that rough period. I mean, is that true? I mean, was he one of the first big drawing cards in Montreal? Or was
He was a drawing card. We're going to hit the Olympics very soon, and he actually won a gold medal at the in Greco-Roman wrestling in 1924. So he was a big name, and he was actually Yvon Robert's hero. He was really Yvon Robert's favorite wrestler when he started following wrestling, and he wanted to be like Henri de Glan. So he was a good draw. I wouldn't consider him the first huge draw of the Montreal territory, though. The first one was without a doubt, and that may surprise some people, but it was definitely Frank Gotch.
Wow.
Frank Gotch was the first first draw in Montreal, but Henri de Glan was very, very popular. But then again, it's Montreal. It's a French speaking territory, so of course a guy talking French was going to be over. It's always been like this, and it probably always will. Made him a part of the other wrestlers because, like I said, there was not at the time there was not a real strong French Canadian wrestler that was really drawing. But de Glan worked a lot before the Montreal Forum. He was working at the Mont Royal Arena, which held a lot less people. But you know, he was able to draw, you know, good crowds there. But you know, the 30s weren't the biggest decade for wrestling in Montreal. But definitely, you know, Henri Declan. You know, his match with Lewis, the screw job, it got, you know, 8,000 people over there. When you know, most of the arenas throughout North America barely had 10,000. You know, so it was a good crowd. You know, he was actually probably the second Frenchman to really draw in Montreal, the first one being Emil Maupas, who wrestled with Frank Gotch. Emil Maupas. Emil Maupas was a wrestler at the beginning of the 20th century, and he became with time one of the greatest trainer in pro wrestling. He trained Yvon Robert. He trained Larry McCann, another guy who wrestled at the same time, the second biggest babyface when Yvon Robert was here. He trained Bob Langevin. He trained many, many guys. He also trained hockey players. He was from France, but he moved here in Montreal, and he opened a training facility in the Laurentians, like maybe an hour north of Montreal, and he became the really first big time trainer in Montreal.
Wow.
Yeah, actually, some of the research I've done in the Maritimes, he was doing some wrestling out there around 1905 as well. So that's why I was perked up when you said his name. So,
oh yeah, probably, you know. Yeah, these guys were working, you know, in a lot of places. George Eichenschmidt, when he came in North America, wanted to fight Maupas, and he chose to do it in Montreal because he knew that he would draw better in Montreal with Maupas because Maupas was French, than, let's say, in New York or somewhere else.
Wow.
Makes sense.
What year was that?
What year was that? That was, my gosh, early 1906, 1908, something like this. I don't have the date by heart, but I can easily... That
prior,
was 1905, actually.
Okay,
May 8th,
so prior to
May 8th of 1905... And the match drew 5,000 people, which was a big gate at the big crowd at the time.
For the time, 1905, that's a very solid wrestling crowd, no question about it.
Yep, definitely.
Dylan, you had been going to ask something there, I think.
Oh, well,
I'm sorry?
I was just going to ask this is a sort of a sweeping question. I know Dave's got some more general specific history questions. I do too, but one thing that's always struck me, because, you know, it's rare that I'm overwhelmed by Canadian fans on the phone. Usually, Dave's the lone Canadian and I'm the lone American. We're reversing course for today. So I do have a question, which is, I think a lot of American fans sort of see Canada in general as just this broad place that exists in the wrestling world where everybody loves Bret Hart, and they may have a vague understanding of some of the other guys that came out of Canada over the years. But really, the territory that's most talked about historically is Stampede. I think primarily because the guys that came out of there went on to be successful with Vince McMahon years later. And one of the questions I have is, how does Montreal differ, in your opinion, Pat, from a place like Maple Leaf, where the Tunnies ran, or the Maritimes? Because all these promotions were unique. I mean, they had a lot of the same guys work for them, but they all had unique cultural flavors to them. I was just curious, the history of Montreal, are there any things that really strike you as being distinct and unique about Montreal compared to, say, Stampede in Calgary, or, Tunney's promotion in Toronto, or the Maritimes, or out west with Altomco? Is there anything that you think is specifically unique about Montreal, maybe a little bit different?
Well, definitely the language here was very unique. That, you know, for those, you know, for the listeners who don't really know about what's different in the province of Quebec. Province of Quebec is the only province in Canada that, you know, most of the people living here speaks French. So it's really unique with this and the French speaking wrestlers were always over or more over here because they felt it was a local hero. You know, Henri Deglan and Emile Maupas weren't from Montreal. You know, they were from France, but because they were speaking French, they instantly became local hero. And you know, if you look at the biggest babyface in the history of Montreal territory, it was always someone who was actually French speaking. Yvon Robert was definitely the biggest babyface, the most popular wrestler of all time in Montreal. He was the El Santo of Montreal. He was any cultural wrestler. He was probably the Ricky Dezan of Japan. You know, it was the same thing. Yvon Robert was bigger than life. At one point, Yvon Robert and you probably heard of a guy named Maurice the Rocket Richard, the hockey player. Well, both of them were kind of the same level as far as popularity in Montreal. So that says a lot.
Yeah.
And after Yvon Robert, Johnny Rougeau took Robert's place as the big baby face in Montreal, another French speaking guy. Édouard Carpentier became a huge star. I mean, he came in 1957 for 6 months and actually never left. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, but he never left Montreal and he became that big baby face as well.
Which year did he come in? 57?
57, yeah. April of 57. So it was really even in the 70s the Rougeau were huge. Did I say 57? I'm sorry, that's 1956. Carpentier came in April 1956. The match with Lutez was in 1957. I'm sorry, guys. He came in 1956, and then Johnny Rougeau started to become, really, really popular at the same time. As the 60s and the 70s came, you had another guy from France who came, who really made a name for himself in North America here in Montreal, and it was André the Giant, as we call him here, Jean Ferré. He was another guy very, very popular, but who could speak the language. The Vachon brothers, even though they were heels, mostly Mad Dog, he was probably the most beloved heels that the Montreal territory ever had. If you speak to Mad Dog, he'll tell you himself. Nowadays, for so many years, he's being idolized by so many people that he always tell the same story where he's going to say, I tried to make people to hate me all my life, and obviously I just failed. In the early 80s, you had four other guys, all French speaking, that really drove the international wrestling promotion for 5 or 6 years. You had the Rougeau brothers, second generation wrestlers. You had Dino Bravo, who for an American may not understand how big Dino Bravo was in Montreal, because for an American, he probably remembers the match he had with Ronnie Garvin in the WWF and him teaming with Greg Valentine, and that was maybe and I've seen those matches as well. And yeah, Bravo was perhaps more of a generic, you know, wrestler, not that, you know, that didn't seem to have a lot of charisma. But in Montreal, it was quite the opposite. I mean, Dino Bravo is probably one of the three or four best drawing card in the history of the territory.
That's incredible.
And
wow.
You had the fourth one was Rick Martel, who's not from Montreal, who's from Quebec City, but, you know, still. So every time Montreal is like, and the province of Quebec is like this. They'll always get behind their you know, a local guy, always. F1 racing was never as big as it was when Gilles Villeneuve was racing,
uh-huh.
and some years later when Jacques Villeneuve was racing. Montreal got behind MMA when they discovered a guy named Georges St-Pierre. Georges St-Pierre couldn't walk in Vegas, and he was unknown in Montreal. And when, you know, he started to make TV appearance and, you know, that the media were talking about him, he became that huge thing. And I mean, you know, he filled up the Bell Center twice.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with in poker, you know, Jonathan Duhamel, who won the World Series of Poker. And now everybody is talking about poker, you know. We always get behind local guys in every domain, you know. Celine Dion is the same thing, you know. So I don't know, and I really believe that why people are doing this is because, you know, we are a small community within a huge country, and we're the only one that actually speak that language. And I think that that's why Montreal wrestling was always a unique territory.
Yeah, I mean, you could even say that even within the United States, there's no state that's as distinct from the rest of it than as Quebec is within Canada and the U.S.
No, exactly. I mean, every state in the U.S. and, you know, they you're gonna hear about accent. You know, he's from Texas. He's from Iowa. He's from here. He's from there. But now we're not talking about accent no more. We're talking about a whole different language.
Yeah.
And by the way, guys, I found the bite match. Was the word I was looking for. It was the Battle of the Bite. That's how it was called at the time, the Battle of the Bite.
Is that what the newspapers called it?
Not. I think that was a name that was given to the match in years after.
Okay.
It wasn't right on the spot. No.
I think Dylan used to use that move as an amateur wrestling days.
Yeah, I was such a successful amateur wrestler. Biting was a huge favorite tactic of mine.
I guess that was the first Battle of the Bite before Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield.
Yeah.
And probably just as significant during the era when it happened.
Oh, well, yeah, probably.
One of the things you were mentioning, Pat, is about, you know, how there's that real identification, like, with the national... Well, not nationalistic, but the local hero and, like, the ethnic hero, I guess, of identifying with someone who's French. I think one of the things that Montreal did a lot, too, is bring in the so-called foreigners. It's almost like the Montreal or Quebec version of Gaijin, of bringing in the monster heels to face, like Killer Kowalski, Don Leo Jonathan. And what kind of role did they play in the history of the province, do you think?
Oh, a huge role. You were talking about Killer Kowalski. He is the biggest, one of the two biggest draw ever in Quebec that actually wasn't from Quebec. Him and Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
Hulk Hogan was a huge, well, he was a huge draw everywhere, you know, one could say, but, I mean, he was too in Montreal, and Montreal was always a Hogan territory, even when he came back in in the year 2000 with WWE. You can even see that on his one of his DVD where he talks about a 10-minute ovation he got here, you know. Kowalski was a huge, huge draw. And you know, probably you heard about the match with Yukon Eric, where Yukon Eric lost one of his hair. You heard about that, right?
Yep, famous matches. I remember as a kid, like the thing I ever heard about Killer Kowalski was that story. Like that was the first thing that you heard about when you were a kid learning about sort of these wrestling figures. One of the first historical footnotes I ever heard about any wrestler was the Killer Kowalski Yukon Eric ear story.
Yeah, exactly.
And we have heard it, but we would love to hear you talk about it.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that match just, you know, it's known not only by wrestling fans, but I mean, everyone heard that story in Montreal, in Quebec, I guess, too. There's some people, anyone who was, I don't know, probably 10 years old and more during the 50s, you know, heard about that match, you know, when it happened. And then it was from generation to generation afterwards. I mean, that match, and technically what happened, it was just an accident. You know, just accident, you know, happens and it becomes, you know, larger than life.
Knee drop off the top rope, correct?
Exactly. Yukon Eric had a cauliflower and cauliflower here, and Kowalski dropped the knee. I don't know if Eric move or just Kowalski miscalculated his move, but anyhow, he just popped his ear. It's as simple as this. That wasn't meant to be, but at the same time, it became a huge, huge, huge publicity stunt for both of them. I mean, at the time, it wasn't Killer Kowalski; it was Vladek Kowalski, and the name Killer came after because. And this is something that is, you know, hard to verify actually, but according to, you know, to all the stories we heard. People started to, there was something about him going to the hospital to see Yukon Eric, probably in a non-kayfabe way. But when he got there, Yukon Eric had that, you know, big, how do you call this? Bandage around his, around his head. And he just looked like he looked really funny. I've seen pictures, and he really looked funny. And Kowalski saw him and just started laughing. And, you know, probably the journalists, all the journalists that were there, just, you know, said that, you know, Kowalski went to the hospital and just laughed at poor Yukon Eric to make him a bigger heel, right? Because the journalists, you know, and I'm sure that was the same thing in every wrestling town. You know, they were writing, you know, sometimes they weren't there to hurt the business, and they were, you know, some of them were even on the promotion's payroll. So, I mean, you know, they were writing whatever the promotion wanted them to write, and they made Kowalski even more hated, and people started, you know, shouting at him, you know, Killer, Killer, Killer. And got the name from there.
Yeah, and someone, I know he was on the Unreal Story of Professional Wrestling, and he said that someone threw a sow's ear at him as well when he was in the ring.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And then what's even better about it is that the rematch took place a few months after, and it was actually the very first nationally televised wrestling match in Canada.
Oh wow!
The rematch between the ear match happened in October of '52, and the rematch happened in January of '53.
That's incredible. So, and that was like a big. That was almost like a catalyst for a sort of a wrestling boom, I guess, in Canada then, or at least for a a bigger profile than it had ever had before.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, if you look at I'm a big statistics fan, okay? I always was in hockey, baseball, and wrestling is the same thing. And if you look at the biggest crowd in North America in 53, 54, 55, 56, and 57, the biggest crowd of the year happened in Montreal in all those 5 years.
Oh, and, wow.
Amazing.
Not just one was the biggest for the 5 years. Each year they had a separate match that was the biggest, or
each year Montreal had the match that drew the most fans in North America.
Okay.
You understand?
That's incredible, though, because that's incredible.
Yeah.
Montreal is not, and this is why I think it's so great that you guys are doing that. This book is going to be coming out, because I'm a big fan of the history of wrestling, and particularly those territories that don't get their due. You know, I'm a huge Portland fan. I'm a big AWA fan, which is odd because the AWA was such a big piece of the area, but it really doesn't get its due relative to a lot of other territories. But Montreal, really, I think, historically, people are aware that it existed as a wrestling territory. They're aware that some big stars worked there. But I don't think they really are aware of anything like what you just said. I mean, that it was, you know, so many big crowds. And, I mean, even myself, watching, you know, footage from the 80s from Montreal, which I've done a lot of, actually, in just the last month or so, even in the mid-80s, when a lot of the other territories had died, Montreal was still doing, at least to the naked eye, very good business.
Hot crowds.
Yeah, certainly very hot crowds.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And you know, according to the stats I have, I mean, you know, New York and Tokyo are in the league of our own, okay, and mostly New York. Mexico City was a huge wrestling city, and there are so many years we don't really have accurate numbers for Mexico that it's probably even bigger than we think it is. But right after those three cities, you have Montreal and Chicago.
Yeah.
And I mean, so if someone says that Montreal was one of the five best wrestling cities of all time, he's right. Montreal was a, well, you know, if you ask me, Montreal was a bigger wrestling city than St. Louis or Boston or Philly and even Toronto. Toronto was never that much of a big, it wasn't near to what Montreal was. Even in the 60s with Bruno, or in the 70s with the Sheik, it really became, they really started to get, you know, big crowds when the Sky Dome and they had one at the Exhibition Stadium, the big event, and then they had the Sky Dome, and that's where, you know, they just skyrocketed and get, you know, all those big numbers like that, the two WrestleManias, because Montreal never used the Olympic Stadium for a wrestling show. So Montreal was stuck with their biggest crowd being at 29,000 in 1973 for a Grand Prix baseball stadium show at the Jarry Park, where the Montreal Expos were playing at the time.
That was a wrestling show, 29,000?
Yeah.
What was
that
show?
Was a wrestling show. They did Jarry Park held the two biggest crowd in the history of Montreal in 1972 and 1973. In 1972, you had the Rougeau, and actually it's funny because yesterday was the 40th anniversary of that show. It happened on July 17, 1972. You had the three Rougeaus on top. You had Johnny against Abdullah in the main event. You had Jacques Rougeau against the Sheik in the semi-main. And you had Raymond Rougeau, who was just starting, against Don Serrano in the other main event. So,
Is that Jacques Senior?
Yeah, that was Jacques Senior. Yes, Jacques Junior only started in 1977. And that show drew 26,237 fans. And it was at the time where there was a big promotional war in Montreal between the Rougeau promotion and the Vachon promotion. Grand Prix Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling. Grand Prix was the Vachons. And it's funny because I ran into...
This would have been during Andre the Giant's time as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was really as hot as WCW and WWF at the time, but just on a more, you know, smaller scale, because it was, you know, mostly in Quebec. But it was, you know, for Quebec, it was as hot as it was throughout the United States and Canada when McMahon and Turner went at it. People, you know, wrestlers were going from one promotion to the other, and they were coming back to the first one after. It lasted only 3 years, but it was a hell of a 3 years. And a year after, in 1973, in July 1973, the Vachon did a show at Jarry Park as well, with the main event being Mad Dog Vachon and Killer Kowalski. And you had also Bruno and Edouard Carpentier teaming against the Hollywood Blondes. And the
Which
show
Dale Hay or Buddy Roberts, and who was his partner again?
It was my gosh, yeah, it was Dale. Dale Roberts at the time here, and his partner was
A future Freebird, for people who aren't sure what we're saying.
Yeah, exactly. The third Freebird, exactly. You're right. And they were managed by Oliver Humperdinck. So Oliver Humperdinck, I had the chance to talk to Oliver Humperdinck before he passed away about the history of his time in Montreal. It was Buddy Rogers and I never answered the question. Buddy Rogers and Jerry Brown. That was the two guys.
Okay.
And they were a huge draw in Montreal at the time. And they were with Rougeau. They left for Grand Prix. And they had, you know, they were working Carpentier and Bruno on that show. And the show drew an even bigger crowd with 29,127 fans.
Wow.
That's a huge figure. I mean, that's for the 70s, that's a... lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. And it was that show was the biggest show in North America that year. And the show the year earlier missed it by 100 people. There was a show at Texas Stadium, main evented by Dory Funk Jr. and Fritz Von Erich, that drew like 100 more people than the Rougeau and Abby match.
Yeah.
So
First Parade of Champions, I think, was the name of that 72 show. They brought it back later in World Class. But I actually didn't know about that. Actually, Pat, will you talk a little bit about what led to the split, or the territory war, with the Vachons and the Rougeaus?
Yeah, yeah. Mainly, Edouard Carpentier was... there's actually a bigger story under what usually people know. I really want to keep that for the book, actually. But the story, believe me, the story, you know, worked the book, you know, itself. Okay, so it's really, really a great story. But mainly, Edouard Carpentier was working with the Rougeaus. He wanted to get out of there. Wasn't happy being there because he was used in the last years he worked for the Rougeaus. He was mainly used as a commentator, and he wanted to wrestle more. So he got out. He wanted to get out of there. The Vachons were always wanted to be their own boss. So Carpentier went to And they try to form a small group of people to create an opposition to the Rougeau promotion. So there was Carpentier. At the start, it was only a Mad Dog Vachon. Paul wasn't in right from the start, but soon after he bought into the promotion and became the promoter of Grand Prix Wrestling. Paul Vachon was really a great wrestling mind, and he's the one who really put Grand Prix Wrestling on the map. And you had also Yvon Robert, who was with them starting the promotion, plus two other guys. One was a lawyer, and another one was just a local promoter.
Clarify too, Yvon Robert. Robert's heyday was the 30s to the 40s, right?
Yvon Robert's heyday was
in the ring,
mostly yeah. 40 and the first half of the 50s. Because
okay.
he was beginning to be a big name in the 30s. He started in 1932, and he was starting to become a big name when Eddie Quinn came in 1939. In August of 1939. And then M and Quinn made the Montreal Wrestling territory a millionaire territory. How we say that, you know, Hogan and McMahon, you know, well, Hogan helped McMahon as much as McMahon helped Hogan. Well, it was the same dynamic here. Even though I believe that probably any smart promoter would have done money with Yvon Robert. But, you know, technically the one before Eddie Quinn, Jack Gansen, didn't know what he was doing because it wasn't as hot as when Eddie Quinn took over the territory. And it was actually, he took over the territory for Paul Bowser. Bowser was still the head of both Boston and Montreal territories. But, you know, I don't know when exactly, but, you know, at one point, Quinn bought the territory from Bowser. So to go back to Grand Prix, they started Grand Prix in 1971. Unfortunately, in July of 1971, Yvon Robert died. So he never really could see, you know, what Grand Prix became. But his son, Yvon Robert Jr., took his share of the company, and he was always known. Usually, the guy that, you know, people know about were Robert Jr., Carpentier, and Bold Vachon. That was the four main guys, well known from the public, that were actually running the company. 71 was a year when they were starting. You know, they had the giant, they had Andre, who came in June. And, you know, they were trying to get dates at the forum. They were trying to be on TV. And everything really happened at the beginning of 1972. So 72, 73 were 2 years where, you know, the war peaked in 72 and 73. By early 74, they were already doing joint shows between the two promotions.
Wow.
The first one really did good, and they did I think four or five, but you know, by the end it wasn't really worth it. And then, you know, Grand Prix closed in 1975.
I got to tell you, I can't wait for the book to get the extra detail.
I'm really
excited about that. That is, that, like, because again, being such a fan of wrestling history, especially, you know, underappreciated and maybe underknown history. Like you said, this is the first book on Montreal, so I'm super excited for just that story alone. Let alone more the details about some of this other stuff.
It is a great story, and I don't mean to tease you guys, but just to let you know, it was a story I found out by complete fluke. Nobody remembered that. I met someone who told me one thing that I didn't understand, made research, and from there I was able to find out this story that really was the reason, the main reason why Grand Prix started. So it's a great story.
That's a good hook. Anybody who's listened to that's reason enough to buy the book. But there's
exactly.
Not that there's not other reasons, but that's reason enough to buy the book. Anyway.
Yeah. And we were talking about outsiders. I mean, of course, we're talking about Kowalski and Hulk Hogan, but Abdullah the Butcher was an outsider too. I mean, he was not from Sudan; he was from Windsor, but still, he wasn't a local guy.
Same with Kowalski, right? Kowalski was actually from Ontario himself. So.
Oh yeah, exactly, right. You're totally right on this. So Abdullah the Butcher, Don Leo Jonathan. These two were great, great draws. Bobby Manigoff in some earlier years was a big draw as well. I mean, honestly, all these guys were bigger draw, in Montreal than guys like Maurice Vachon or Rick Martel, because they actually wrestled more years in Montreal than Vachon and Martel. You know, both guys, Mad Dog and Rick had, a greater career outside of Montreal than actually in the territory. But we talk about all those guys as well. We're not only talking about the Montreal wrestling territory. We're talking about every guy that really made it from Quebec, from the province of Quebec. Guys like René Goulet, who wrestled all over the world and, ended as one of the best agents in WWF. We all saw René Goulet come out for a brawl, for a pull apart in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, he was Pat Patterson's assistant. And Pat is another guy. I mean,
yeah,
Pat Patterson's from Montreal. And he became that wrestling genius and to any people I spoke to, even last weekend in Waterloo, Iowa, for the Tragus and Tez Hall of Fame, everybody I spoke to, and I asked the same question: how much important was Pat Patterson for WWF? And everybody has the same answer: it would have not been the same without Pat.
Yeah.
And he's a guy from Montreal that never had a great career in Montreal.
And one of the great workers of his era too, one of the great in-ring performers of that era by every accounting that I've ever heard.
Oh yeah, exactly. Him and Rhys Stevens were one of the best tag teams ever.
Yep.
And
they were neck and neck with each other, I would say, from everything you hear. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as we all know, Pat Patterson was the creator of the Royal Rumble. I mean, who can say they invented one of the biggest pay-per-view, wrestling pay-per-view that we still have to this day, right? Another guy that was from Montreal that had a very good career was Ronnie Garvin.
Yes, one of my favorites, actually.
Ronnie Garvin was NWA champion. Well, okay, he didn't have a great run, but... If you want to know who he blames, he said it in interviews, but we're talking also about it in the book. But he had a fantastic career, and he's another guy from Montreal. And since his name is Ronnie Garvin, and since Pat's name was Pat Patterson, it doesn't sound really French. So people... there's many people that probably never known that these two were actually friends. And the two of them were Terry Garvin, who wasn't actually Ronnie's brother, but who had also a good career and was an agent as well with WWF. They were all going to the same high school in Montreal. They all started together being trained by the same guy in Montreal, Pat Gerard, who trained many, 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 many wrestlers. He's the biggest trainer ever in Montreal. He became bigger than Emil Mopa, actually. And the three of them moved to Boston in the early 60s and started their U.S. career all at the same time. So I mean,
I have a question for you, Pat, actually, about some of these guys that, you know, maybe had better success elsewhere. You talked about how so important the local heroes were there because of, you know, the cultural difference and significance of in Montreal, Quebec. But how was it seen when somebody like Mad Dog or Ronnie Garvin or even Rick Martel with the AWA title, how was it seen in the province of Quebec and in Montreal when they would win the world title, so to speak, of those other promoters? Was that seen as like a big deal with wrestling fans
guys,
in that area?
Guys, I'll be right back.
Yeah, was that seen as a big deal with wrestling fans in that area, or was that just sort of like, you know, okay, these guys are wrestling somewhere else?
I'd say that probably Martel was the bigger deal of the three, only because he actually was AWA champion and wrestled in Montreal and in Quebec City at the same time and was defending his AWA title at the same time. In the 80s, he was, many people believe that there were some kind of working relationship with the AWA, but really there was nothing really signed or anything. It's just because Rick was AWA champion, it was only natural to bring some AWA contender in Montreal. And you know, wrestling works the way it always been, you know. So you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So when Vern wanted, you know, some fresh talent, well, he was going to ask Gino Brito. So, you know, guys like Dino Bravo and even King Tonga worked for the AWA at the time as well. But there was really nothing, you know, it wasn't nothing on paper. It wasn't a contract between the two promotion. It was nothing of the sort. But, you know, guys like Nick Bockwinkel and even Jumbo Tsuruta and Stan Hansen all came to Montreal when Martel was AWA champion. When Mad Dog Vachon was AWA champion in the 60s, he was only wrestling in the United States. He wasn't, you know, he did a few shots in Montreal here and there, working with Paul in tag teams, but he was never really billed in Montreal as the AWA champion. Ronnie Garvin, well, that's another thing. The NWA is something that is not really known in Montreal. It was always about WWF because they were the only TV we were getting. The NWA TV wasn't, you couldn't watch this in Montreal until 1988. And as ironic as it is, it was at the time that Ronnie Garvin actually was the NWA champion. But WWF and Hulk Hogan were so over the top in Montreal. It was a year after International Wrestling closed down, and it was, you know, just McMahon territory by the time. So, and it was on a new TV station that, you know, didn't really draw good ratings. So,
as a little fact of one of my heroes, I believe Leo Burke did French commentary on that.
Totally, exactly. You're right.
Yeah.
But the NWA, you know, Ric Flair came in the 80s to work guys like Gino Brito and Raymond Rougeau and Rick Martel in Montreal and Quebec City as the NWA champion. But it was never. I'll tell you a little story. That happened years and years later, but just to give you a hint of how NWA really didn't mean anything in Montreal. In 2009, I was promoting for Ring of Honor. They did two shows in Montreal in November of 2008 and April of 2009. In April 2009, we scheduled a third show for July, and it was at the time where Ric Flair was doing dates for Ring of Honor. And they booked Ric Flair in Montreal for July. And the pre-sale, the pre-sale was just bad. And by a week after, it wasn't better. So they decided, and you know, the April show didn't do that well either, so they just canceled Montreal. They did it in Toronto instead, and then that's why you guys had two shows back to back, Friday and Saturday, one with Bret Hart, one with Ric Flair. But what I'm trying to say here is that. What I'm trying to say here is that when I was talking to Carrie about it, I told him that Ric Flair wasn't a big draw in Montreal, and he was never a big draw, and that a guy like Abdullah the Butcher is a much bigger draw in Montreal than Ric Flair will ever be. And to prove that, the same year, April 2009, Abby was billed in his... It was billed as his last match in Montreal. The newspaper talked about him, and he drew 500 people at an NCW show. It was co-promoted by NCW and Devin Nicholson, and it drew 500 people, more than the two Ring of Honor show in April and November. So they couldn't, I remember him and Sydney couldn't believe it, couldn't believe that Abby was actually a bigger draw than Ric Flair. Because in the States, and I guess even in Toronto, it's mind-boggling to think that Abby would be a bigger draw than Flair. But in Montreal, we never got the TV. We never got NWA TV. If we go back in the 50s when Eddie Quinn was a member of the NWA, yeah, okay, that's something else. But even guys like Lutez Russell was one of Eddie Quinn's best friends. I was talking to Lou's widow in Waterloo last weekend, Charlie, and she couldn't stop talking about how Lou was how much he liked Eddie Quinn. You know, he would have killed for Eddie Quinn mainly, you know. But Lou wasn't really a big draw in Montreal, even with him being the NWA champion. Hugh Conerick was a bigger draw than Lutez in Montreal. Bobby Managoff, Argentina Roca, all of the Rougeaus were a bigger draw than Lutez. Buddy Rogers was a bigger draw. And the list, you know, there's maybe 20 guys who were a bigger draw than Lutez. He was a well-known name, you know, but his bigger gates were always when he was working a guy established in Montreal. But the NWA, for I don't know what real reason, never kind of fit with the Montreal territory.
I always saw Montreal as kind of more independent anyway compared to, say, Toronto, who, of course, worked with the Crockett's and then with Vince even, before, you know, in talent exchanges. I always saw Montreal as sort of more independent to begin with, so I don't know if maybe that had something to do with it. One thing that I just recently learned is actually when Martel dropped the AWA title, part of the injury angle that they did to set up when he lost the belt to Stan Hansen at the Big Medellin show was done in Montreal in a match with I think it might have been a tag team match against Sheik Ali and I forget who else, but they did an angle where they injured Martel's back. So that was a kind of a quirk. I actually think they may have even showed it on AWA TV. Montreal actually may have, as an aside, played a role in Rick Martel losing the AWA title in storyline perspective. But
and you're right, because I mean, at the beginning of the 80s, you know, some guys from the WWF were coming here. You had Bob Backlund, who actually worked in Montreal at the beginning of the of 19, you know, international wrestling started in 1980, and you had Bob Backlund working here at the time. You had at the same time you are also AWA, some AWA guys. I mean, Pat Patterson was with the AWA at the time, and he worked in Montreal. We had what was called a rematch of the Shea Stadium showdown between none other than Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant in Montreal in 1980. That was actually the first sellout crowd at the Paul Sauvé Center that International Wrestling did. 7,000-something, they sold out Paul Sauvé Center. That was really the rebirth of wrestling in Montreal. You had NWA guys that came also. Like I said, Flair came here. You know, so you're right when you say that Montreal, you know, in the 80s, but I think throughout his history, has always been kind of independent. You know, of course, you know, Vince Sr. was close, you know, in New York. And you know, but still, you know, you had Vince Sr. was close, but never took over the territory. You know, maybe he had some good working relationships with some promoters. But at the same time, in the 70s, you had the Vachons who were, you know, were known all over the world. And if you ask Paul about it, he'll tell you that that helped them a lot because they knew so many wrestlers and they were alike from so many wrestlers all over the world that it wasn't difficult for them to bring them to Montreal. I mean, you know, you had the Crusher who came to Montreal at the same time, at the same time that Bruno Sammartino came to Montreal working for Grand Prix. So you had people from all over the different territories working here. I mean, Roddy Piper had, when he first broke into business, he was working the Maritimes and did a few matches in Montreal as well. There's so many wrestlers who actually in the 70s. You also had Ricky Choshu, who actually wrestled in Montreal. Right. At that time.
Was that for the Vachons?
No, it was for, I think it was for the Rougeaus. I may be wrong on this, though. I'm not, honestly, that's a good one. I'm not sure.
It was
at the time where the Japanese guys were just doing, you know, North American tours, and Montreal was a stop they did. I mean, Giant Baba wrestled Bruno Sammartino in the early 60s in Montreal.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was awesome. When I actually discovered that, I was quite amazed. And Montreal was the only territory that before McMahon actually took over the territory, he had to work with International Wrestling. You know, usually McMahon was taking a territory. You know, he was you know, putting himself on. He was getting the TV first, then he was getting the talent from the local territory, and then it was over. In Montreal, he wanted to get the. He already had the TV. He wanted to get the Montreal Forum, and the president of the Montreal Canadiens, Ronald Coré, with the general manager at the time, Serge Chavard, were running any dates at the Montreal Forum, and they told McMahon, well, you know, we are working with Frank Valois and Gino Brito and Dino Bravo, so you're going to actually have to work with them if you want to present your stuff in you know, in the Montreal Forum. So he had to do a few joint shows with International Wrestling in August, September, October, November, December, and January of 1986. And after that, well, you know how McMahon is, you know. So, you know, Vince was already, you know, he had all the contacts he needed after 6 months. And it was announced in the newspapers that, you know, WWF were the only one who could use the Montreal Forum by then. And that was really, you know, he took the Rougeaus in February of 1986. And by the end of 86, he also added King Tonga, Dino Bravo. King Tonga was, by the way, in the 80s, one of the good draw. You know, we're talking about outsiders. In the 80s, Tonga was a big, big name in Montreal. So yeah, he added Tonga, Bravo, Martel, Frenchy Martin. You know, he took anybody actually wanted. And then, you know, International Wrestling closed down in June of 87. So yeah, Montreal was really independent to the point that even Vince had to somehow – you know, work with International Wrestling before taking over the territory. So, you know, you're really on it. You're really on the point by saying that.
Yeah, and I think that, I guess that's why, you know, in watching some of the Montreal footage that I have from that period, that explains why there was some WWF video packages here and there on their TV shows. I wondered that, but maybe they were, because a lot of the promos are in French, which I don't speak. I barely speak English. And you know, it looked to me like, okay, well, this is strange that they've got these, you know, WWF promos put in here. But maybe they were for hyping those joint shows you were talking about, because it's right around the same time frame. Late,
yeah, but they always kept French interviews for years in Montreal. Raymond Rougeau, when he became interviewer and commentator, was hired. And for that, especially at some time, you know, Vince was didn't have to do French interviews for the Montreal market, but because he wanted to give Raymond someone who he really, really had a lot of respect for, he wanted to make him work. So he actually did French interviews. And so he could, you know, he could give Raymond a job. And not that Raymond needed a job. by that time Raymond was self-made. But he, out of respect for Raymond, he wanted to give him something, and that's why he kept French interviews for a long time after that, even in the 1990s.
One guy that I was wondering about, if he ever did much wrestling in Montreal, I think he must have done some, and if he was a draw there, is Whipper Billy Watson.
He did work. Billy Watson was, I guess, he was the Yvon Robber of Ontario or Toronto.
Yeah.
He did work. He did some. Actually, he did have a few matches, I think, against Yvon Robert, but he also teamed with Yvon Robert a lot. But he was never a big draw in Montreal. He did work the territory, but it was, then again, culturally speaking, it made sense that Watson wasn't that much of a draw in Montreal. He wrestled at the end of the 40s. He wrestled Bill Longson and Robber and Sanders Svabo and all those guys did tag teams, you know, against Yvon Robber, with Yvon Robber. Sometimes it was a heel, and, at one point he was also a babyface. But he was never that much of a draw in Montreal. But I mean, you know, he wrestled he wrestled until maybe 1956 in Montreal, or mid-50s in Montreal. You know, people, you know, my dad is, you know, I always refer my dad as, you know, when I want to just have a checkpoint on something that happened, you know, in the 50s or the 40s, my dad is 81 years old. He's older than anyone of the people my age. Their dad is usually my dad was born in 1931. So he was going to wrestling shows when he was a kid, and even in his 20s and stuff. So when I want to just have a sounding board of, you know, what really happened then, you know, if a guy was known, I usually ask my dad, who has still a great memory. So Billy Watson was a guy he knew, that he heard of, but never to the level of even a Lutez. And I mean, nothing compared to the Kowalskis and Abdullah the Butcher or Don Leo Jonathan or any of these guys.
And I think when you're comparing Toronto and Montreal, I think Whipper Watson and Yvon Robert are very comparable. I think one of the biggest things that Toronto falls short on from Montreal is that they didn't then have an Carpentier or an Andre the Giant or anyone who was a big deal after Watson. Like, that's when they really started going to kind of contracting out to the Sheik and then to the Crocketts and stuff. So
I like to say that Yvon Robert was a much bigger local hero than Billy Watson was, just for the fact that I'm not really sure if I can really be wrong, and maybe maybe Greg Oliver would just curse on me if he hears this, but I'm not sure if Billy Watson was as popular as a huge sports name like Maurice Richard. And maybe this is something that is unique to Quebec as well. You know, I mean, English-speaking guys, you can find that in Ontario, but you can also find some in any other province. French-speaking wrestler, it was something that was unique to Montreal and to the province of Quebec. So I'm not sure if Billy Watson was as popular as Yvon Robert was, locally, I mean. I just think that, I really think that Yvon Robert was closer to El Santo to what he really brings locally to the province of Quebec. And I'm really not sure that's... I'm sorry?
Watson was more of a San Martino, which is a great thing to be. It's just a little.
Oh,
different.
Exactly. Yeah. That I agree. Yeah, he was pretty more like a Bruno San Martino, which is still a big deal, like you said.
It's not even a smaller deal. It's a different thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a different thing. Yeah, you're right. And Watson wrestled. When did he stop wrestling? Like in the 60s or early 70s?
Very early 70s, he got in a car accident, and that finished him off.
Yeah, exactly. So Yvon Robert started earlier than Watson, but Watson was longer on TV than Robert because, you know, by the end of the 50s, or even before that, mid-50s, Yvon Robert had stopped wrestling. He was pretty much managing Johnny Rougeau. So by early 70s, he was unfortunately dead. So Watson probably had more TV time than Robert, because Robert started his career, in 1932, when, like 20 years before TV arrived in Montreal.
Yeah. Well, and Watson also became very known as a philanthropist and doing a lot of charity with Easter Seals. And he has a school and a public park named after him and a wing of a hospital. But, I mean, Tiger Jeet Singh now has a school named after him in the area, too. So there you go.
One of the all-time greats.
Yeah.
I want to ask Pat, without giving anything away that he might want to reserve for the book, but how did midget wrestling get its start in Montreal, like you alluded to at the beginning of the show?
Well, we usually know about midget wrestling is that Jack Britton, I was saying earlier on, with Gino Brito's father, who was a wrestler, back in the 30s and, 40s, him and his brother, actually, Lou Kelly, they were both wrestlers. And Jack Britton started promoting midget wrestlers. The very first ones were, Sky Lolo, and soon after, Little Beaver came with them, and they had also little Brutus, who was at the time named Tiny Tim Gerard. He's the same guy. Little Brutus and Tiny Tim Gerard is the same guy, and he had others, like Pee Wee James and Mighty Schultz, but there were a lot of guys actually from Montreal who were wrestlers, who were midget wrestlers. And basically what he did he started to tour the world with midgets. Gino Brito started pretty much being the driver of the midgets. You know, is that you know, Jack Brisson had a racing territory down in Detroit with Bert Ruby, and Gino Brito started, you know, what his dad was doing. He was sending Gino with four midgets on the road to a few towns. Gino was paid, I think, I don't remember exactly, like a few pennies per kilometers, or maybe per miles, I guess. I think 1 penny per miles or something like this. And, you know, he was bringing, you know, the midgets to a wrestling show. The promoter would book Gino in the undercard, and the midgets were the big attraction. So Gino really kind of started that way. But, you know, at the same time, he could have three different cars touring the U.S. with midgets. You know, he had, I don't know, 12, 16 midgets, you know, that were at the same time touring, you know, and they went to Japan, they went to everywhere in the U.S., Canada, and so many other places, and became,
and
you know.
And they'd hit most places a couple times a year kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how Jack Britton started promoting the midgets.
It sounds very similar to the setup with you know, like Mildred Burke and Billy Wolf, without the sexual relations.
Exactly. And I mean Jack Britton also promoted women's wrestling at some time during that period as well, but not to the level of I guess, you know, Burke and Billy Wolf, or even Mueller afterwards. But just for your record, Jack Britton, after that, you know, had share in both the Rougeau promotion, and at one point he had share also in the Grand Prix promotion. So he was one of the big promoter that Montreal had, and he passed away. He passed away in February 1980. And he was running the Montreal territory for like 4 years, and didn't have any TV time. So he was, you know, drawing something like 2,000 and 3,000 people, and the biggest, well, not even 3,000 people, less than that, 1,000 or not even 2,000 people. And his biggest gate was in February 1980, the day after he actually died. So he never had to see. Yeah, he never had to see his biggest gate, who was a match between Pat Patterson and Captain Lou. Well, I'm not sure if he was captain at the time, but Pat Patterson and Lou Albano. And because only because you know, New York TV was shown here in some channel in Montreal, so people, you know, knew them from TV. So they went on the show, and that's when Gino Brito took over his dad's promotion. Well, he took over the promotion in Montreal, but you know, it was a separate company. But he wanted to follow in his dad's footsteps. But what you will find out in the book is what happened before Jack Britton promoted the first, you know, promoted midgets, and probably how Jack Britton actually got aware of midget wrestling. So
that's a good hook. I like that.
that is something you will find in the book. It's another kind of fluke story that, you know, at one point I met the right guy that told me the right story, and all the pieces, you know, were placed together, you know, like a jigsaw. And it's another great story that you'll be finding out in the book.
I would love to hear that that you found out that there's a tradition of midget wrestling going back to colonial times in Quebec.
Well, yeah, well, that would be a great story, but actually it wasn't.
That's not it? No.
Okay. No, that's not it.
Gino Britton, Gino Brito's great, Jack Britton's great, great grandfather was driving midgets to wrestling shows in a horse-drawn carriage. In the
yeah.
No, that isn't that
little beaver.
But you know what? You know what? You're just making me think of another thing that is particular to Montreal, or actually to the province of Quebec, is that we had great Native American wrestler that actually were from the province of Quebec. Three in particular, Chief War Eagle, who was a wrestler from the 20s and early 30s, who actually traveled, you know, throughout North America. And, you know, was a great wrestler. His son was, you know, well-known under the name of Don Eagle. Don Eagle, who actually was at some point the AWA champion, the same AWA from Boston, who was a big, big hit on TV when TV started, you know, had matches with Gorgeous George and all those great wrestlers. And he actually was involved in a screw job himself, in the United States, and the funny story about this is that the referee who was involved in the screw job, his first name was Earl. So I just think that is a great story. We tell the story in the book as well. And another Native American, they all link together because, you know, War Eagle was Don Eagle's dad, and Don Eagle trained Billy Two Rivers. The three of them came from Kanawake, an Indian reserve, a Native American reserve, I don't know, half an hour from Montreal, just on the other side of Mercy Bridge. So I mean, you know, there again, you know, three of the best Native American wrestlers of all time were from the province of Quebec. You know, I like the line that ECW Press came with when they printed their catalog, and they said, you know, you will probably find out that what happened in wrestling might have happened in Montreal first, and you know, I don't want to put Montreal bigger than it was, but I think it was, you know, a big wrestling city. And you know, to a certain extent, a lot of things happen in Montreal, you know, before it happened elsewhere. You know, promotional wars were probably, you know, it happened, you know, in many cities, but the 70s promotional war was really, really, really something strong. I mean, I ran into Jim Cornette in the Ring of Honor show and in New York City the other day, and I was telling him about the book, and he told me, oh yeah, and you know, with the 70s wrestling, and you know, it was like the hot, you know, rivalry between the two promotions that was, you know, unheard of, and you know, he knew about that. He knew about that war between Grand Prix and All-Star Wrestling. The midgets, the Native Americans, the screw jobs, you know, a lot of things over the years happened in Montreal. And you know, that's I never got why a book on this great history was never written before. At the same time, I'm glad because me and Bertrand will be able to talk about all of these great stories first.
Yeah, and Bertrand, I got to meet him at Wrestle Reunion. He's a really nice guy too.
Bertrand is one of the best wrestling minds that I know, and probably one of the best booker that Quebec wrestling had in the last 20 years. He is such. Wrestling savvy, and he has a great knowledge on you know, he must have read every single book on wrestling. He is really, really, really a great, great wrestling mind. And you know, since he was a bit older than me, he was the perfect match for me because, you know, he actually – had many more memories of just the 80s part because, you know, since he was older than me, you know, I was six in 1982. So my dad brought me to my first wrestling show when I was six. Bertrand was already 11 by then. So he had, you know, he really saw the first, you know, years of international wrestling, and he had a more vivid memory of a few things. So just a quick story. When I asked Bertrand to help me with the book that, you know, I was already working on, the first thing I asked him to do was a Rick Martel biography, right? And I wanted something like, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 words. And he actually came up with 11,000 words. It took me 8 hours just to edit it to 3,500 words, and I couldn't do more than that. You know, it took me 8 hours to do that. And I told myself, okay, I think I have the right guy with me now.
Yeah. Pat, could you talk about how you came about of wanting to be a wrestling historian and kind of your progress in becoming
Well, this is not something you really want to become. This is something that kind of, you know, I didn't wake up one day saying, what am I doing these days? Oh, yeah, I'm going to become a wrestling historian. I don't like being called a wrestling historian. I think I'm a pro wrestling historian with a specialty as university guys would say, with a major on Quebec wrestling, because this is really my strong side. Of course, I know about, you know, the rest of wrestling, definitely. But I really know really, really, and I try to concentrate myself just on Quebec wrestling, and that is just that. It's I put up many hours just, you know, learning about that history. I was, like I said, I was a wrestling fan since I was 6 years old. You know, I couldn't miss, you know, those Sunday morning at 11 o'clock watching international wrestling here. I always, you know, kept following wrestling. One of my friend that I was going to university with opened a website in 1999, and by the year 2000, I started, you know, writing a few articles for him. And in 2001, he did a big relaunch of his website and to include more and more Quebec wrestling indie scene. And he started being involved in one of the promotion here named the FLQ, who was run by Paul Leduc of the Leduc brothers. And his son, Carl Leduc. So he started to be involved, you know, in the commission.
Paul would be Joe Leduc's brother, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, gimmick brother, but yes.
Okay.
So he started as a kind of commissioner kind of role, and I followed right after, you know, starting to manage a few guys, and that's what really my start in the wrestling back in October 2001. So I worked for a few promotions, and in 2004. I always liked the PWI almanacs, you know, the Pro Wrestling Illustrated almanac that they were, you know, doing, they still do every year. And I wanted to do something, you know, something like this for Quebec wrestling. So I started working on this, and at the same time wanted to create the first Quebec Wrestling Hall of Fame, Pro Wrestling Quebec Hall of Fame. So I had a few contacts, you know, with Paul and with other guys. You know, so that's when I started to meet with guys like Gino Brito and Ray Rougeau and Rick Martel, and all these guys, you know, were voting and still are for the Quebec Hall of Fame. And so once a year for 4 years, I did those small magazines, Almanac, once a year, recapping, you know, the whole year on the indie scene, top 50 of the best indie wrestlers, awards of the year that I still do to this date with the top 50. It's on my website now, quebecwrestling.ca, cheap plug. And So I did that for 4 years, selling it myself, going to shows all over Quebec. I even went to Toronto a few times for some BSC show and another show down there. I did go to CZW to sell it. Ring of Honor were selling those on their website because Tina and Generico were working for them at the time. And I was selling it online as well. So, you know, make a long story short, I did that for 4 years, and then I was talking to actually Dave Meltzer, and Dave told me, I was asking him if he would want to be voting on be on the voting committee for my Hall of Fame, and he declined, saying that, you know, you really had to be from Quebec to really, or near, you know, Quebec, to really understand fully what the territory was about and how great guys were here, maybe compared to what they were doing outside for, you know, like we talked for Dino Bravo. But he, along his answer, he said, but you really should do a book on the history of pro wrestling in Montreal that has never been done before. So I started to think about it, And you know what? I'm completely dead wrong on what I'm saying. Man, my memories is already starting to go bad. I was asking him for the fifth anniversary of my. Okay, let's go back a few minutes now. Okay, you know, listeners, I'm really sorry. You just erase Men in Black thing. Just erase whatever happened in the last 2 minutes. for the fifth anniversary of my almanac, that actually never happened. I wanted to work on the top 25 of the best Quebec wrestlers of all time. And I asked Dave to vote for the top 25 wrestlers of all time from Quebec. And that's where he gave me that line, you know, that you couldn't do it because you really have to be in Quebec to really understand who was better than, who was more popular, who was a bigger draw, blah, blah, blah. And
that's
said,
a pretty humble step to make, actually.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And he told me, but you shouldn't do just a top 25. You should do a book on the history of promising Montreal. It has never been done before. So that thought started to stay in my mind. And I actually read one day when Karol Kowalski passed away, a guy from Montreal who was the publicist for IWS, Michael Ryan, whose internet name was Lacor, he wrote a great piece on Killer Kowalski's career. And I read, as I was reading this, I said, man, that's exactly the guy I should be working with for my top 25, I didn't know it was that much into, you know, wrestling history. So I approached Mike. And while we were talking, you know, he said, well, why don't we do, you know, more than just a top 25? Why don't we, you know, start to do interviews with the guys and make, you know, talk about other stories that happen in Montreal wrestling history? And I said, yeah. I mean, you know, and I told him about that Meltzer line he threw at me. I was like, yeah, you know, that was, you know, on the back of my mind. And finally, I started working on the book with Mike, but Mike had, you know, other obligations, and he wasn't able to put as many time as he'd like to on the book. So that's where I got Bertrand the summer of 2009 to help me. And at first, the book was supposed to be written in French. It was actually, but we couldn't find any publisher in Quebec because they just think that wrestling is dead for so long in Montreal or in Quebec that actually it wouldn't sell enough, so they wouldn't make profit out of it. I strongly disagree, but you know, that's their prerogative, right? So so I mean, by working on the book, I really started to get, you know, more knowledge on Quebec wrestling history, and I had a big break also locally when Edouard Carpentier passed away. I was able to I was the one actually that, you know, all the media kind of call, you know, to have interviews and to have, you know, contacts and about who they could interview and stuff when Mr. Carpentier passed away. So yeah, from there, you know, I kind of, you know, started to be, I guess, you know, more known in the wrestling community and in the media here and, you know, wrestling wise in Montreal. So it was just something that happened because, you know, I'm a big mouth and, you know, I run my mouth every time I have the chance to, and I'm not shy at all. And I will go see anyone anytime because I always feel that the worst case scenario is, you know, the person will just, you know, tell me no, or, you know, tell me that he doesn't want to speak to me. So, you know,
that's going to happen much, but
yeah, exactly. I mean, so technically that's how I it's funny because, you know, in Montreal, you know, when the word historian came along, you know, and was tagged to me, I even promoted myself in a sense as a wrestling historian. I got some heat from people in the, you know, Quebec wrestling business because they say, oh, you know, Le Proud is just a big head, you know, saying that that he's an historian, you know, did he really study in that, you know, but, you know, then again, there's no, you kind of have a degree on wrestling history, you know, that's not something possible. There's no.
I'm sure if you could, everyone on the phone right now would try it, but.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, you know, so you know, I always, you know, thought of myself as someone who has great knowledge of Quebec wrestling, who likes to share that knowledge with other people. And you know, it got me to meet with so many people that are even more knowledgeable than me. You know, guys like, we name some, Dave Meltzer, Greg Oliver, Steven Johnson, J. Michael Kenyon.
You got to meet Steve Yohe recently, didn't you?
Huh?
Steve Yohe, you met recently, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I met Steve Yohe in Vegas. I mean, I was really looking forward to meet him because, you know, I've read a lot of stuff from him on the Wrestling Classics message board. And I even sent him an email one time about the first Montreal Screwjob because he was referred to me by Greg Oliver as being the specialist on that. And he never answered me, actually. He never got back to me. So when I met with him in Vegas, he was actually introduced to me by Steven Johnson, and I was with Greg Oliver just watching, you know, we're on my laptop, and we were just going through a few pictures I had in my computer. Because the other thing me and Bertrand are trying to do for some years now is to try and get as many wrestling pictures collection from as many people we can. I don't know if you ever heard the name of Tony Lanza.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Tony Lanza, for the people at home who actually don't know him, he was a former wrestler and he was mostly a photographer who you know, since the 40s. Have been taken, have been, you know, he took so many shots from so many wrestling shows, and he was doing wrestling and also bodybuilding. You know, he had all Arnold Schwarzenegger, Arnold, I'll just leave it like this, in his basement before, you know, he was even a movie star or anything. So he had that great, great, great collection. You know, he took all the great ones. You know, it's like huge what he has. He passed away in late, 2007, 2008, something like this. And his children were kind of sour that there was not a lot of wrestling people at his funerals. So they decided to throw away everything he had. Pictures, the negatives, everything.
Wow.
When we heard that story, me and Bertrand didn't want that to happen ever again. So while we were interviewing wrestlers and while we were, you know, talking to, you know, people in the business, we're always trying to get, you know, their personal collection and scan it on our laptop. So that way, you know, they don't leave, you know, we don't take their collection away. We go to their places with our laptop, with our scanner, and we just scan those pictures. And by doing so, we ended up having Ray Rougeau's personal collection, Rick Martel, Gino Brito. We had many other, maybe, you know, lesser known guys, but that had great pictures collection as well. Paul Ludzik's collection was really, really awesome. And Paul Ludzik's collection included Bob Langevin, Legs Langevin collection as well. I mean, Monday I was out at Ann Schmidt. I was out at Ann Schmidt's house. Well, he passed away.
Wow.
He passed away a month ago, and I called his widow, who was really, really nice. She told me that she didn't find a lot of things, but I was welcome to go there and see it. And finally, I ended up scanning pictures for 3 hours. There was great, great, great pictures that I've never seen before, or pictures that I've seen in some magazines, but never on the, you know, in their original forms. So we did that for a lot of people. And even the main photographer in the 80s for international wrestling, a girl named Linda Boucher, who her and her mom were having wrestling magazine every month for many, many years in the 80s here in Montreal in France. She has pictures from international wrestling from 1980 to 19 even. After, you know, when WWF came, until 87 or 88 or so. And I have all of her collection. So we have, like, I don't know, 10 or 15,000 pictures that, you know, including the indie pictures that we also have, me and Bertrand, you know. You know, all the indie promotion. We have a lot, and that's what we're trying to do, is to keep as many pictures as possible and make sure it stays within the wrestling community, you know, because it, not only collections may be thrown away, but, you know, it's the same thing if it's being kept by someone who don't care about wrestling. It's in a basement of someone who will never be related to wrestling again, you know, the grandson of somebody or the children of another one. And you know, in years and years and years from now, these collections will just be lost and we'll never hear from them again. So all this, to go back to my story with Steve Yoey, we're in Vegas, we're looking to all these pictures, and all the other documents I had. I have a spreadsheet of all, you know, I have like over 1,500 shows in Montreal or in Quebec with the, you know, the crowd. It's an Excel sheet, actually, with the crowd, the main event, the date, the location, the venue, so I can sort it out really easily, you know. And that's a trick, you know, I would advise anyone who wants to keep track of crowds or anything, do it on Excel, because it's so much easier after that. You know, if I want to sort it out by wrestler, by crowd, by venue, by city, it goes, you know, faster than if it's a word sheet. So we're looking through all this, and Steve Yoey looked at me and said, "Man, you're the person with the most information on one single territory I know." and I was going there, and I was looking forward to meet with Steve Yoey, and he's the one telling me this. I was just amazed and quite happy that, you know, my work was recognized by someone that I was looking up, like Steve Yoey, actually. And
quite a compliment. Yeah,
exactly. So So I was quite overwhelmed by all this. So you know, that's the thing I like the most, I think, being, I don't know, being dubbed, you know, the Quebec wrestling historian, is to be able to talk wrestling with great guys like all of them. And you know, in the same way, Dylan, we don't know each other that much, but Dave, we met a few times, and it's the same.
Yeah, we met
the same
before
way.
Last year, and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean that's the best thing of all, is to be able to talk with all those great guys. And just for your records, Steve Yoey told me that he would answer all of my emails from now on. So
that's pretty awesome. Pat, one story that we didn't really get into that you'd mentioned Ed Carpentier there. Can you talk a little bit about the match between him and Thez that led to the formation of the AWA?
Yeah, it didn't really lead to the formation of the AWA. This is a misconception that people have.
There you go. Good to talk to you about it.
what happened is the NWA was looking for another champion. Because Lou was either going to Europe, so they wanted a champion in North America, and if the Europe deal wasn't gonna work, and it didn't, well, at least they would have got, you know, two champions they would have got two champions, you know, they could have, I guess, maybe drawn more money, you know, with two guys, you know, running separately, you know, with the NWA title. But at the same time, they really kept themselves an open door if they ever wanted just one champion, or if they ever wanted to give back the belt to Lutez when he comes back from Europe or something. So what they did is that when Carpentier won the match in Chicago in 1957, he won it because Thez got injured during the match and couldn't continue the match. But all the newspapers sold it as a win by DQ. So by saying that, if they ever needed to bring back the title to Thez, they could always do it, you know, saying, well, you know, we sorted out, we watched the match again, blah blah blah. It was a DQ, and you know, we gave back the belt to Thez. So basically, that's what happened there. Then. Thez really didn't go to Europe, stayed here, and at the same time, Eddie Quinn didn't really want Carpentier to be the NWA champion because he quickly realized that the cut he was doing on Carpentier's booking as the NWA champion wasn't near to what Carpentier could make him if he was wrestling in Montreal, because as an NWA champion, he couldn't be wrestling only in Montreal. So that's what happened there. So Quinn actually left the NWA out of this, and you know, other issue he had with the NWA, so basically what the NWA did with Sam Muchnick is that they just gave back the title to Thez. Thez won a match against Carpentier, but nobody will ever know the real, you know, thinking behind this, you know, because, you know, all the people that could have talked about it are actually not with us anymore. But I had the chance to interview Carpentier. I had the chance to do the last interview with Edouard Carpentier, actually. And the last, I did two interviews with him, but the last one was only on this match and this period. And he actually didn't know much about it because that wasn't on his level, right? It was things that were decided above him. He knew about a few things, but you know, basically he was told he was the champion, and well, according to him, he lost the title at some point, and that's it, you know. But he knew about a few things that happened between Eddie Quinn and himself and the NWA. But you know, he gave me maybe a few hint about, you know, just how this thing worked, but nothing much. The right guys to talk to, I guess, would have been Sam Mushnick or whoever in the NWA offices that actually took that decision. But basically, after they put back the title on Taz, they just decided to erase Carpentier from the title history. Completely erased it. So that's why you never find the name of Edouard Carpentier in any NWA title history done by the NWA. But other territories still recognize Carpentier as the champion. One of them was Boston. So Carpentier stayed champion in Boston for a long time. Then another territory was Los Angeles. And Carpentier, being the champion of Los Angeles, that title lineage is the same that got the WWA promotion title lineage as well. So the WWA started their title history with Carpentier being the champion in LA. And the other one, the other big territory that Carpentier was known as the champion, was Omaha. And so he was recognized in Omaha, but had lost the belt. When the AWA got started with Vern, Carpentier wasn't the champion in Omaha anymore. But Vern was the last Omaha champion before he created the AWA. He wasn't the last champion, but he had won the belt. And Pat O'Connor was the champion in Omaha by the time that the AWA got started. And when Vern started, he took that lineage into his promotion, saying that Pat O'Connor was the champion, the first AWA champion. And I think Pat didn't work or didn't want to work with the AWA. Finally, Vern took the title. But the lineage of the AWA title that Vern used was from Omaha.
Okay.
And that's why people are saying that Carpentier was actually the first AWA champion, but that's really just a misconception because he never worked for the AWA at that time. Actually, I'm not even sure if he worked in the AWA period.
To my knowledge, he never did. When I was going over AWA results, I don't remember ever seeing his name on the on.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how this. But the match was really, really important just for Carpentier recognition of the world champion in three other territories that make good business, and you know, that led to the creation of the WWA title, and to a certain extent, yes, to the AWA title, but you know, it's a stretch to say that he was actually the first AWA champion.
Well, you could almost just as much say if he was part of the WWA lineage, that he was as much, you know, that he was part of initiating the business in Japan, because that's where Ricky Dozan kind of really blossomed. So
yeah, Yeah, so I mean the story behind the Carpathia and the NWA, this is something you know we write about in the book definitely that was a sure thing, but this is something you can also if you go on Wrestling Classics and I wrote I wrote about the interview I had with Carpathia. On that website, there is one or two topics on that, and that's pretty much reading this and reading, you know, guys like Steve Yoey and Crimson Mask and all these great wrestling historians talking about what happened, and that's really that plus, you know, all the things I read. You know, Tim Hornbaker, NWA history was a great help as well. For me to really understand what happened there, so you know we gave a certain story of what we believe what happened. Is this really exactly what happened? We'll probably, you know, never know.
I have two other things, and heaven forbid Dylan might as well. The Wrestling Observer news update today had mentioned what you said earlier about the July 1972 show, I think,
mm-hmm.
the Rue show. It also mentioned July 1957, if you wanted to talk about that show being the anniversary yesterday as well.
Well, it was the 55th anniversary of Killer Kowalski winning the international title in Montreal for the 11th time. He beat Gene Kaniski at the Delormier Stadium. I'm sorry?
That must have been an awesome match.
Well, I guess. I'd like to say I was there to witness it. But it was when we were talking about the biggest match, you know, as far as drawing fans, you know, in the 50s, you know, when I was telling you guys that the Montrealite had the biggest drawing card throughout North America for 5 years in a row. Well, the fifth year was 1957 with Kowalski and Kaniski. That was exactly that match that drew 21,851 fans at the Delormier Stadium. The Delormier Stadium was the baseball stadium where the Montreal Royals were playing. Montreal Royals was the team that Jackie Robinson played with before going to the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know, when we hear about Jackie Robinson playing in Montreal, that was for the Montreal Royals, and they were playing at the Delormier Stadium. That was the biggest stadium, outside stadium in Quebec at the time. And the 5 years from 53 to 57 that drew the biggest crowd fan number was actually at the Delormier Stadium because it could hold more people there than actually in at the Montreal Forum. So yeah, that was the story behind that match. Kowalski, and actually in the book, you know how difficult it is to try and make wrestling title history, you know, because you know there's always some shenanigans happening, you know, that never are aware of, you know, some phantom switch, you know, some Rio de Janeiro tournament that never happened, you know, and that kind of
somebody
thing.
Somebody biting their own arm.
I'm sorry?
Somebody biting their own arm.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, guys, can I just go back to one story I told you? Because, you know, I have a good knowledge of everything that happened in Montreal, but sometimes, you know, my memory is I'm off on a few things sometimes. The Omaha world title that I was telling you about, that was actually my first idea was right. Vern was the last Omaha title holder, And he actually named Pat O'Connor, who was the NWA champion of the time, his first AWA champion. He, you know, knowing that the NWA wouldn't allow O'Connor to go and defend the title, you know, in another, you know, what they were called, like, you know, outsider promotion, you know. So he actually merged the Omaha World title with the AWA title and named himself world champion at the time. So that's the story that I wasn't really sure from memory. And Carpathy was the first title holder in Omaha in 57, and that's where, you know, that thing with Carpathy being the first AWA champion. It's like saying that Carpathy was the first AWA champion is like saying that George Akinchman and Frank Gotch were the first NWA champion.
Sure.
Okay, that's how far away it actually is.
Yeah.
Now, what was the question again? What was the thing I was talking about? Then I'm getting lost. What were we talking about, guys?
Well, one of the things I was going to mention is, like, it seems like a lot of big cards were in July. Was that kind of a WrestleMania-type season almost?
Well, no. It's just that it was the time of the year because of winter in Quebec that it was the time of the year you could use outside stadiums. And
okay.
Because the Laurier Stadium and Jarry Parr Stadium were baseball stadium and there was no, like, roof or anything, so they could only be used in the summer, and they could hold more people there than in the Montreal Forum. But that wasn't what we're talking about, though. That's a good question, but that wasn't what we're talking about, and I just can't remember what you guys asked me.
Well, I'd ask you about Kowalski versus Kaniski.
57.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. What I was about to say is that it's hard to really find a good wrestling title history because, you know, even more, you know, back in the days. But me and Bertrand are really proud to say that we actually have the whole Montreal title history from 1936 up until 1987.
Awesome.
And we really didn't miss anything, you know. Even the Phantom Switch, we have them. We really have everything. We searched through the National Archives here to be able to really track down every title shot because the Montreal title started in 1936. You know, that was the Athletic Commission world title, you know, that was a title recognized by the Montreal Athletic Commission, and it was it started in 1936. Then when Eddie Quinn took over, that continued there. It continued with the Rougeau promotion in the 60s and 70s, and then with Jack Britton in that era of the end of the 70s where there was no TV, and then Gino Brito continued it in the 80s until the closing of the company. So the Grand Prix title was something aside from that whole lineage that goes back to 1936. So this is something that is that I thought I was really proud of because that was one of the hardest things to actually research. So
yeah,
talking about Kowalski winning the title made me thought of that thing that you guys will also be able to find in the book.
I want to ask you real quick about the Ledoux's. You've mentioned them sort of in passing, and you know, I think Joe Ledoux is sort of fairly well known for maybe fans of 70s and 80s territorial wrestling in the United States, especially the southern part of the United States, which is where I live.
Mm-hmm.
You worked a lot of, you know, regional territories around here. How big a deal were they in Quebec? Because I know obviously the Rougeaus were a big deal as far as wrestling families and the Vachons. How big a deal were the Ledoux's? Obviously, I don't think they were that big relative to those two, but were they a big deal in Montreal?
The LeDucs are part of the biggest feud in Montreal wrestling with the Vachons. During that war, you know, that promotional war in the 70s, end of the 60s and early 70s, because they started having matches with the Vachons back when both teams were working for the Rougeaus before Grand Prix got started. But in Grand Prix, they really, you know, really, really had a great feud. They sold out the Coliseum in Quebec City many times, and they had really, really great matches together, bloodbaths. You know, it was really, really a hot feud. Probably the biggest feud, well, like I said, not only the biggest feud in that time, but certainly, you know, you can arguably say that, you know, it was the biggest feud ever in Montreal wrestling history. That being said, Joe was always a bigger name than Paul because of one particular thing. It was his size. I mean, Joe was that 6'3", 6'4", big guy, and Paul was a smaller guy. So anytime, you know, you wanted to do one-on-one, when it was always Mad Dog Vachon and Joe LeDuc. Both Pauls were, you know, and for different reasons, but both Pauls were kind of put aside from when they wanted to do just one-on-one. Joe LeDuc won the world title in Montreal from the hands of Johnny Rougeau. He's one of the rare guys who actually, one of the rare local guys who actually won the belt from Johnny Rougeau. And you mentioned it. I mean, Joe in Memphis, you know, with Jerry Lawler, he made Jerry a lot of money. In Florida also, in Tampa, both of them won the tag team championships too. So I mean, Joe became a much bigger name. In Montreal, He was a very good baby face. The team was, you know, it was funny because sometimes when they started their career, they were heels. But the fans just turned them baby face because they were really, you know, those two lovable lumberjacks that people got behind. And the gimmick Joe LeDuc had in the States was completely different from what he had in Montreal. I mean, in the States, he was that psychotic lumberjack who licked blood out of his axe. And in Montreal, he was big Joe LeDuc. I mean, in the 80s, as a babyface, he was hulking up. He was doing an hulk up. I mean, it was really like getting a beating, and then like Hogan was doing, you know, he was getting hit, and he was just, you know, it didn't hurt him anymore, and bing, bang, boom, and he was winning the match. So he was completely two different character in Montreal and in the United States in the 80s in particular.
And he's really good in some of the footage you can get from the Montreal in the 80s as well.
Yeah,
exactly. But so Joe LeDuc was always a bigger name because, you know, he was in single. He was always put, you know, in the bigger matches. You know what? The Jerry Park show that drew 29,000 people. It was supposed to be at first between Mad Dog Vachon and Joe LeDuc. But the LeDuc went back to the Rougeau promotion before that ever happened.
Wow.
So Joe is still, I mean, there are some people to this date in Montreal that think that both were actually brothers.
Yeah.
and they were not. But you know what? Both changed their name legally for LeDuc. And both guys' kids are truly LeDuc because they were born in Quebec. When you maybe it's like this in the States as well, I don't know, or in other provinces, but When you change, when a parent changes his name, his children are changing their name as well, or can change their name as well. So all three children of Paul's are named Leduc, and Joe's children are named Leduc as well. And both families were always got close to another. I mean, you know, I was talking to Carl Leduc and to Kim Leduc, who was a promoter in Montreal at one point. And it was, you know, when they were young, it was Uncle Joe. And they considered Joe's children as their cousins. So they weren't brothers, but, you know, they ended up being so close that, you know, it's almost like they were, you know. But, you know, both guys were named Leduc right from the start, so.
I'd like to make a proposal right now that we start a rumor that the three of us are brothers.
I'm sorry?
I want to start a rumor that the three of us are brothers.
The three of us are brothers?
Me, you, and Dylan, that we're all brothers.
But I'm not changing my name for Musgrave. That's you know, we all going to be LePrad's brother then.
One of the things I wanted to mention, too, is that you brought up Hans Schmidt briefly, and he's another great one from Quebec that had a great career. So.
Yeah, he's another guy who had a bigger career in the States than in Quebec, actually. When he actually came back in Quebec, he got to wrestle in the 60s for the Rougeaus, but, you know, his heyday was really in the 50s when TV started with Dumont Network in Chicago, and he was a big hit right from the start. And see, that's one thing that people are trying to, you know, there's some people who are knocking Schmidt's career because they say that it was just the right gimmick at the right time, you know. It was a German gimmick, and, you know, like a few years after the war, and it was on TV when TV started. So they some people are trying to you know, devaluate Ann Schmidt, saying, you know, that it was just the good gimmick at the good time. But I mean, I think that, you know, Schmidt was really, he became really a draw, you know. I mean, you know, you everything in wrestling is being the right gimmick at the right time.
That's right.
I mean, Terry Bollea had the right gimmick at the right time with the right promoter. So, I mean, is anybody going to knock on Hulk Hogan because he was just the right gimmick at the right time? And I'm not in no way comparing Hogan to Ann Schmidt, but just, you know, this is wrestling. This is, you know, he may be the right gimmick at the right time, but okay, he was, but he could have dropped the ball on it, and he didn't, and he became a big star in the U.S. And in Montreal it was somehow different, because in Montreal he was always known as Guy LaRose playing Hans Schmidt. He was doing the German still, but I mean, in Montreal you could detect his German, his non-German accent, his Montreal accent, his French-Canadian accent when he was doing promo. So it was different. That's why many guys from Quebec actually played Russians or German. I mean, Michel Dubois played Alexis Smirnov, a Russian. Mm-hmm. He was French-Canadian. Because it was somehow different. You know, he just needed to talk. He could be talking a broken English. And, you know, it wasn't really that obvious, I guess, that he was French Canadian, but in Montreal, we noticed that accent, right? We could tell. So, but Ann Schmidt, and I mean, Ann's never. I heard promo in French of Ann Schmidt. I mean, So it was different, but it, then again, it was, you know, 10, 15 years after, he really was a big hit in the States. He did a few good prisons in Montreal as well. Even being, you know, the draw of some great cards, great shows with Edouard Carpentier, especially. He had a good feud with him in the '60s. So he was. See, in 1959, he had a big feud with Carpentier that, you know, stayed into the 60s. He won the championship here in Montreal a few times as well. And he even became a shareholder of the Rougeau's promotion by the end of it.
And I made the joke on here before about Schmidt, but it's interesting that he's a Canadian who pretended to be a Nazi, considering how many Nazis after the war came here and pretended to be Canadian.
Yeah. That's kind of ironic. And it's funny because he was more doing of a German gimmick than he wasn't really into that the Nazi really really like strong Nazi part of the gimmick. That wasn't really Hans Schmidt. He was more doing a German gimmick than that whole really Nazi part, you know. There were guys who played
It kind of carried that baggage with it without him actually trying to act like a Nazi.
Yeah, exactly. Hans was another one from Montreal. You know, where I was talking about Patterson and Garvin and all those guys. Well, he's another guy from Montreal that his career was way much bigger in the States than here.
Dylan, I think you had some questions there.
Well, I just have one more. I don't want to hold you guys hostage on the line forever because I could literally talk about this forever and never get sick of it. But
yeah,
I do want to ask one kind of final question, at least on my end. I know the territory itself closed up in, you know, the middle of 87, and I think the last match was actually a cage match with Gino Brito Jr. and Abdul the Butcher, I think. But
it was Gino Brito, not Jr. It was Senior.
It was Senior.
Yep.
And what I was going to ask is, you know, watching a lot of the stuff from that period, because I have seen a pretty good amount of the stuff that's available from, you know, the 84, 85, 86, and then on up to the company close. Even right up when the company closed, I mean, they clearly were not drawing big. But compared to some of the other territories that were still trying to survive, you know, places like Central States or even the AWA and Portland and other territories that had been stronger, Montreal still seemed to have really hot crowds. And the crowds seemed to be bigger. I mean, they weren't huge by any stretch of the imagination. I don't want to oversell that. But they didn't seem to be as anemic as some of those other territories that were going by the wayside right around the same time. Obviously, the writing was you know, on the wall by that point in 87. But it's my understanding that it was a bankruptcy when they went out of business. And I'm sure there's a long story to that, and I don't want to go into too detail, but I was just curious, how quick was the actual fall? Because, you know, in 85, they appeared to be doing really good business, and then it dropped off pretty dramatically.
They had the Rougeaus and the Garvins at that point.
Which was a great feud, and then it just seemed like it dropped off really quick, but it never really felt like it was on its deathbed the way that the AWA would become, or the way that Central States or some of the other territories would really be, you know, just almost sad to watch. Montreal obviously hit a low point in terms of talent, but it never really struck me as sad to watch. So I guess I'm asking just a general question about those last maybe year or 6 months when it looked like things were done for.
But let me ask you a question first. When you're saying that it wasn't as bad as Central States or AWA, How much were they drawing as far as crowd? You know, how much people did they draw at the time?
Well, Central States was drawing in the hundreds. The AWA, which I mean, people forget, the AWA was still drawing very, very well. Up really until the summer of 85 is really when it got really bad, and then it really collapsed entirely through 86. But by the time 87 and 88 hit, they were still trying to run full loop. And they were really, if you went back and looked, there was probably very few shows from 87 forward in the AWA that did more than 1,500 people. And that's actually worse than it sounds when you consider the fact that they, you know, theoretically had a national TV deal during that period and things like that. So, but their crowds also just weren't as hot as the Montreal crowd. I guess that's also kind of what I'm getting at, is the Montreal crowd seemed way more invested, even at that late date when the company was, you know, sort of a piecemeal combination of guys that were left because everybody had gone to Vince or was, you know, finished working for the territory. It still seemed like the crowds were hotter, and even like the crowds were better. I mean, that could just be an optical illusion, but it certainly seemed that way to me.
Well, actually, the fallout really started when International Wrestling lost TV to Vince. That was in December 1984, and actually, you guys know about the Black Saturday, you know, in wrestling, you know, when Vince went to TBS.
TBS. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, that kind of thing happened in Montreal, in the sense that in 1 week we were listening to International Wrestling, and the week after it was WWF. That was in December of '84, and then in August of '85. That's where WWF started doing joint shows with International Wrestling. And by January 86, like I was saying, well, you know, Vince took control of the Montreal Forum. So he had TV, he had the biggest venue. And then, you know, well, it was only a matter of time. Well, he had the Rougeaus in February. And if it was not for Dino Bravo getting hot at Vince, because Vince was supposed to do a match between Bravo and Hulk Hogan in Montreal. But he was, just to let you know how much of a deal Bravo was in Montreal, he was afraid that Hogan would be second in popularity to Bravo in Montreal. So he decided not to do the match. So Hogan wrestled Bob Orton, I think, and Bravo got whoever, I don't remember who he wrestled, but some other, you know, just a mid-card guy. And Bravo was hot at Vince for that. So he decided to stay with International Wrestling a bit more. By the fall of 86, money was too big for Bravo to refuse going to Vince. And he saw that the business was just falling down. Gino Brito admitted himself that he kept the company longer too long, that he should have closed, you know, much earlier. But he kind of took it personal, trying to compete with Vince. And, you know, that's why at the end of it, he just went bankrupt with it, losing, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars with it. By the end, the very last show in Quebec, because after the last show in Quebec, there were still a few shows in Ontario, in Scarborough and Owen Sound, and maybe a few other. But you know, by I'd say early July, you know, there were no shows running anymore. But they did those Ontario that Ontario tour because the advance was good, and you know they knew they wouldn't be losing money at least. But in Montreal, it was doomed. They had TV, you know, on a regional network that, you know, it wasn't everybody who actually got it. So TV time was drew nothing. And the very last show was supposed to be held at the Verdun Auditorium, you know, where they they were doing a lot of shows at the time. They had stopped running the Pulse Ove Center, which was too big and too expensive. They changed for the Verdun Auditorium, but the advance was so bad that they actually switched the show to the Laval Coliseum, a small town like half an hour north of Montreal, well, just on the other side of the river on the north shore of Montreal.
Dino Bravo was from there, right?
Yeah, well,
Dino Bravo
lived in Laval. Yeah, exactly. El Generico was born in Laval. Just a quick note like this. So they switched the show there because they actually Laval was less expensive than Verdun, and the last show drew something like 600 or 700 people. Mad Dog Vachon retirement tour, his last match at Pulse Ove Center was him teaming with Joe LeDuc, you know, something that was honored of because, you know, these two had been feuding forever. And it drew only 900 people.
Wow.
So, you know that, you know, your days are counted when your days are numbered when you draw that kind of a crowd. As far as being, I couldn't compare it to the territories you're telling me about, Dylan, because I don't have any recollection of those crowds. But Montreal was always perhaps a hot crowd. It's still to this date, you know. I believe Montreal fans bring something special to the table. You know when a referee goes one, two, and then everybody goes two. Well, it's actually started in Montreal on a small indie show that, and you know, maybe people will just think, oh, that crowd is just bragging and he's crazy. But it was actually my friends who started this in the IWS show. And we, after that, we went to a Raw show in Montreal and you know, tried to convince all of our section to do the same thing. And it kind of picked up from there. So Montreal was always, you know, a special crowd, like New York crowd or like Philly fans. And maybe that's why you have the perception that Montreal was always maybe drew more or that it was hotter, but technically the territory was losing money. You know, you cannot bring Bruiser Brody and have Abdullah the Butcher and Steve Strong and all these guys. And, you know, bring only 700 people, because it wasn't 700 people paying $30 or $50 a ticket like it would be for a big indie show nowadays. It was in 1987, and I don't know the prices exactly, but it must have been something like $7, $8, $10 for a show, something like this. So it's not, you know, there was no way they could have, you know, really, you know, done money with these kind of crowds, so you know, international wrestling in '85 was still able to pretty much, if not, you know, sold out Montreal Forum, you know, still drawing something like 15,000-18,000 people there, and 2 years after it was down to 700 people, and they couldn't even use their secondary, well, not their secondary, but I mean the Pulse Ove Center was where they were holding shows every Monday night, and that was too expensive by the end of it. So it closed down like every other territory closed down when Vince took over. Actually,
well,
Stampede Wrestling was kind of lucky in a sense, because Vince bought them for $1 million, never gave a dime to Stu, and just told Stu, well, you have your territory back. You know, I took all of your talent. You know, everybody knows who WWF is in Calgary. Just take back your Stampede Wrestling promotion. Hopefully for guys like Owen, like Chris Benoit, like Chris Jericho and all these guys from the second generation of Stampede wrestling, hopefully for them that happened. But Montreal never had, you know, they had what I was saying earlier, that they were the only one to actually do joint shows with WWF. But, you know, once Vince took over, he just took over. And since then, there's still no local promotion who actually had a regular primetime TV deal and who actually was able to be a regular promotion, drawing like thousands of people every week, or running the Montreal Forum every month, or anything like this. Jacques Rougeau once held the show at the Montreal at the Molson Center when it was called that in early 2000s. That drew 12,000 people. Because he is Jacques Rougeau, because that's a household name in Montreal, but he did that once. And his shows are drawing good because he has a way to sell tickets to his sponsors, actually to give tickets to his sponsors. So most of the people who are going to his shows don't actually pay for their ticket. They were giving the ticket. But still, Jacques got money from his sponsors for these tickets, but it's a weird way of having fans. But still, you know, he could do shows with 1,000 or 2,000 sometimes, even more than that, a few shows. But this is nothing, you know, this is something he does like 12-15 times a year. He's not on TV. He tried to, but no. So it's been like 25 years. It actually marked the 25th anniversary of the closing down of international wrestling, and it's kind of a sad anniversary, if you ask me.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Ask me another question. I don't want to end this on a sad note.
Well, let's talk about some of the indie scene and some of the great guys who've come out of there. Like, perhaps it's not a, like, obviously Steen and Generico, and you're quite involved with NCW and are. You know, you've worked quite a bit with Lufisto as well. So if you want to talk about that, that would be great.
Yeah, yeah, actually, and we're talking about the indies in the book as well. It's far from being a big part in the book, but still, we're covering the late 1800s up until today, and I believe that Kevin Steen and El Generico are two talent. Well, probably the two most talented wrestlers that, you know, the province of Quebec had in the last 20 years. That actually started wrestling in the last 20 years. You know, Pierre Carwallet was a great talent as well, but he had started in the 80s, and so has Jacques Rougeau or Rick Martel. But that actually got their start since 1990. Steen and Generico are two heck of a wrestlers. I don't even know if we're gonna have two guys like this, you know, again. I've seen Generico. Well, actually, this Friday on July 20th is gonna mark the 10th anniversary of the El Generico's gimmick. It was an IWS show, and I was actually at that show, and it just started as some kind of a joke. It was nowhere supposed to become that monster gimmick that traveled, I don't know, 29 countries in the last 10 years.
Yeah, he wrestled in Russia this year.
Huh?
I said he wrestled in Russia this year.
I know. I mean, he is champion in Sweden. How many wrestlers how many wrestlers do you know wrestle in Sweden? Nonetheless, being a champion in Sweden, I just marked down for him being champion in Sweden. I just thought it was the greatest thing. So seeing Generico, I've seen Generico's first match in Paul Ludzik's promotion, SLQ, that I was telling you guys about earlier. That was in 2002. I mean, I've been around him for all of his career, even though I'm closer to Steen now. But, you know, I've been following Kevin Steen's career, you know, since he got out of Rougeau. And, you know, his big break in Quebec was actually in Quebec City against Christopher Daniels, so for EWR promotion in 2004. And that four-way at CZW they did with Excess and Sex City, who was in the fall of 2004. It was named CZW Best Match of the Year. It was just awesome. And from then, they were booked to Jersey All Pro, another four-way a month or two after. And then they kind of really hook up with Super Dragon, who brought them to PWG. And then, you know, from their reputation at PWG, they got Ring of Honor dates. They went to Japan, and, you know, the rest is history. So I mean, I've been around these two for pretty much the past decade. And I mean, you know, I'm you know, every time, like, when Steen won the Ring of Honor world title, I was just really proud, you know, because, you know, in a sense, it's just sad that, you know, people in Quebec are not aware of who Kevin Steen is, because he's not on TV, because he's not in the newspapers. But still, you know, they are really, like, two great talented guys. I mean, Sylvain Grenier is someone that we talk also in the book, because he's the last WWE wrestler who actually was from the province of Quebec. And I mean, you know, he's a four-time WWE tag team champion. You know, that's maybe it was in an era where the tag team championship, well, it cannot be worse than it is today, but still, it wasn't a good era for tag team wrestling. But still, you know, this is something he'll have forever.
It's not like he was just being squashed by Ryback or something like that. I mean,
exactly. You cannot take away what he'd done, you know? And Lufisto, I mean, you know, Lufisto is a great friend of mine. And I know her for, you know, 11 years since I started in this. And I mean, you know, the Femme Fatale promotion in Montreal is probably the most internationally known promotion out of Montreal. And they're, you know, they're working with great companies like Shimmer and WSU. So Lufisto is without a doubt the best female wrestler of Montreal, not to be named Vachon. You know, only Vivienne and Luna Vachon, as far as I'm concerned, were better wrestler than Lufisto in the history of female wrestling in Montreal. That's another thing we talk in the book too, the history of female wrestling in Montreal. Doing, you know, biographies on, you know, the three of them, and of course Maryse Ouellette as well, who had a good run with WWE,
Vivian Vachon. There was a wrestling book, wrestling movie about her called Wrestling Queen, wasn't there?
Wrestling Queen, yeah, exactly. That WWE bought the rights to when they bought recently the Mid-South Library. So, exactly. And Luna, you know, was such a good worker, and I was fortunate enough to have an interview with her maybe a year before she passed away. So I'm glad, you know, that I was able to do that, and, you know, we have a very good biography of her in the book as well. So the indie scene is just the usual indie scene that, you know, any big city will get. You know, we have our highs and our lows, and for every like Sylvain Grenier has a promotion now, and for every Sylvain Grenier who brings, you know, some former WWE talent, or, you know, some big indie guys, and can draw something like 1,000 or 1,500, like three times a year, there is promotion that every week will draw something like 20, 30, 40 people. You know, the usual indie scene that you know, you've seen around in the States and in Ontario as well.
Actually, the biggest Montreal wrestling promotion right now seems to be in Ottawa. So,
well, C4, yeah, and I mean, I like to consider C4 part of our family, our Quebec family, because of two reasons. First of all, Ottawa was always a city run by the biggest province of Quebec promotion. Eddie Quinn was running Ottawa. The Rougeaus ran Ottawa. The Grand Prix ran Ottawa. International Wrestling was running Ottawa as well. So that's part of the reason. The other reason is that C4 is using so many talent from the province of Quebec that it's kind of a, you know, to me it's kind of a Quebec wrestling show as well. And you know, Ottawa is just on the other side of the river, you know, from the province. So yeah, but I mean they're doing great. You know, depending on what criterias you're actually taking, and you know, you can always argue who's really the best. NSPW in Quebec City is maybe the best kept secret in Quebec wrestling. I mean, the last show they did with Lance Storm against Kevin Steen and the Super Smash Brothers wrestling on the show as well in a street fight against two local guys over there drew near to 500 people. I mean, 500 people in indie wrestling is a big crowd.
Yeah, it is.
You know, well, 150 people is a good number nowadays. So let alone 500 people, and they're running. You know, they're actually doing a bit. You know, some well, depending of the month, them and C4 are going at it, you know, who's having the bigger crowd. But with that 500 people that they got in May, they this is something C4 has never had so far. So, but they're both, you know, running shows, you know, with 250, 300 people every month. TOW, which is Sylvain Grenier's promotion here, is running like 3-4 times a year, you know, with big shows, but they're doing also, you know, some festivals and some campings throughout the summer. But they're doing, you know, bigger shows like 3-4 times a year, and we're able to draw something like 1,000 or 1,500. So that's still, you know, big crowds. Rougeau, like I was saying, still has to be considered a big indie promotion. And Femme Fatale, well, they're not in the same league as far as drawing people. But you know, they're the more talk about Montreal promotion, you know, elsewhere, you know, throughout the States and Canada. So you know, we still have very good workers. The Super Smash Brothers, I mean, they're one of the best tag team in indie wrestling right now. And this is not just in Montreal. This is like North America. There's the PWG Tag Team Champion, 2CW Tag Team Champions as well. We got Alex Silva, who got signed by TNA. Okay, maybe because...
Matthew St. Jacques and Thomas Dubois.
Yeah, I mean these two...
And Mike Bailey, who I'm a big fan of.
And Mike Bailey, too. If they can really, Dubois and St. Jacques, and they have all the potential in the world to wrestle elsewhere. 3.0 wrestles Shikara all the time. We still have very good talent, but still, you know, it's on an indie level, and you know, unless Montreal gets back, you know, wrestling on TV, these are guys that will never be known to, you know, the mid card, even the jobber guy in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, is probably most remembered and well more known than any of these guys, you know, as far as the general public is concerned.
Yeah.
But this is the same case for every other cities, you know, on the indie scene. You know, it's if you're not in WWE, you're not just a well-known wrestler, even TNA wrestlers sometimes, you know, they don't get really the recognition that they should, considering they're on TV every weekend on pay-per-view and everything, you know. But this is the era we are. And but yeah, so in the book we talk about the indie and the indie scene, but like I said, not that's not the big part, you know. Readers will mostly read about the four great eras of wrestling in Montreal. The first one being early century with Frank Gotch and with George Kennedy. An interesting story about George Kennedy was he was a former wrestler who was the promoter in Montreal when 1905 until 1920 or so. And you'll find in the book that he was also the owner of a great hockey team named the Montreal Canadiens.
And I've heard of that.
He was promoting wrestling at the same time. So that's a great story that people will read about. So that was really the first era, great era of wrestling. And then you got the Eddie Quinn era. Then you got the promotional war era. Then you got the international wrestling era. And I mean, ever since, and it's WWF. It's Vince eras. And I mean, you know, Vince drew really well in Montreal for many, many years. When he took over the territory, he was doing one show per month in Montreal at the Montreal Forum, you know, because you know in the months prior to WrestleMania 3, Steamboat and Savage main evented two big shows in Montreal that drew one was near 20,000 and the other one was about 20,000, I think. So he drew well. I mean, the Survivor Series, well, we didn't even talk about that, but it's been talked so much about. But we believe that, and I can be wrong on this, but we believe we're going to be the first wrestling book that's going to be talking about that since Brett and Vince and Sean all, you know, made up, you know. Since Brett returned to WWE and since they did that you know biggest rivalry DVD and so we talk about, you know, we talk to a lot of people about that, and we're able to have the most updated version of that match, and this is something great that people are going to be able to read about. I mean, Hogan's run in 2002 and 3 with the WWE was awesome for Montreal. So we talk about that as well. So we've got to have great stuff in this book, and 460 pages, and it should be
Four hundred sixty-ish.
We don't have. I don't think there. You know, it could be maybe a few pages more or less, but it's going to be around 460 pages with about maybe close to 200 pictures in all.
Awesome.
So
I'm looking forward to it. I'm big time. I actually wish it was coming out this week instead of February, but it'll give me something to look forward to in the new year. So I'll hold that over. Do you have anything else that you want to plug real quick? Your website or anything else you want
to
plug?
Well, yeah. It's every year at the beginning of the year, I'm having my update for the Quebec Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and for the awards of the year in Quebec indie scene. You can find this on www.quebecwrestling.ca. I'm also, well, this is, my website is both French and English, so that's fine. But I also have a column on the RDS website, which is the sister station of TSN, or for you to learn the French, ESPN, if you will. So I'm having a regular column there on it's a column / newsletter on Quebec wrestling, and you know everybody, you know, it's, you know, I'm talking about all the guys from Quebec, past or present, and everything that's going on the Quebec indie scene as well, or when, you know, TNA or WWE are coming in town. So, but it's in French. So, I mean, any French speaking people here who's listening to the show can read it. But I mean, you know, you can also have a good web translator and probably read my column as well. And I'm having a lot of articles on Slam Wrestling from, you know, anytime Greg Oliver needs something from Montreal territory, I'm usually the guy who writes it. And, you know, when I go to, like, the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Waterloo, I do a write-up for Greg. So my last write-up was about this Monday, about the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. So you can find more articles I wrote on Slam Wrestling as well. Yeah, that's about it. The book will be released in February. ECW Press, who've done so many great wrestling books in recent years, are our publishers. So we're really, really in, you know, into it, and we're, you know, hoping that everything will go smooth when the book gets released. And I hope I'll be able to be brought back to your show when the book gets released, because we talk about 3 hours, but honestly, and you know it, we could have talked about another 3 hours about Montreal wrestling, and maybe when you will read the book, we could talk more about some of the stuff I kept you kayfabe about today.
Absolutely.
That's Pat, I gotta say, I think this is probably the best show we've ever done. It's been awesome having you on.
Well,
we'll definitely have you back.
I really appreciate that, and I just hope that my strong French accent, as some people would say, was not too bad to listen to our listeners over there. You know, I'm from Montreal. What can you say? You know, I'm trying my best. And
it'll help us get that kind of Pepe Le Pew kind of demographic that
well, if I can bring you a few more French listeners to your show, you know, my job will be done then.
Right, yeah. That's right. You'll be our draw. But anyway, it was great having you on, Pat, and great talking to you as always, Dave. And we'll definitely have Pat on again when the book is released. But I guess that's about it for tonight.
Well, thank you very much, guys. That's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Pat.